The Gulf Oil Companies and your neighborhood Good Gulf dealer present We the People, with music by Oscar Bradley's orchestra.
This is Milo Bolton welcoming you to We the People for Gulf Oil.
I dipped into the future, far as human eye could see. Saw the vision of the world and all the wonder that would be. Saw the heavens fill with commerce, argosies of magic sails, pilots of the purple twilight dropping down their costly bales. Heard the heavens fill with shouting, and there rained the ghastly dew from the nation's airy navies, grappling in the central blue.
That prophecy of aviation might was written by Tennyson more than 100 years ago. Tonight, We the People honors our great armies and navies of the air, and we dedicate this program to the 7th War Loan Campaign, because our bonds will buy new and better planes, fuel, ammunition, and train pilots and crews for our great air armadas winging to victory in the Pacific. Marine Air Station on the West Coast, the Commandant speaks.
For her heroism and courageous devotion to duty, which were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service, the Distinguished Flying Cross is awarded to the Queen of Rabaul.
Who is the Queen of Rabaul? Well, here's Marine Captain James Burris of the Red Devil Squadron who'll tell you all about her. Let us in on that secret, huh, Captain?
Well, Mr. Bolton, the Queen of Rabaul is a Grumman Avenger torpedo bomber. She's flown 122 missions, has over 700 combat hours in the air in the Pacific. Besides that, she's been flown by at least 40 pilots, and not one of them has ever been hurt flying her, including me. Plus that, she's won the Distinguished Flying Cross for 19 Marine pilots. And furthermore, she's the second airplane in the entire history of the Marine Corps to wear the Distinguished Flying Cross herself.
Well, Captain Burris, how did the Queen of Rabaul happen to get her name?
I guess it's because she made more runs over Rabaul than any other torpedo bomber in the Corps. A lot of bombers made runs out there, Mr. Bolton, but you can take my word for it, none of them came through like the Queen. Why, she didn't fly, she walked through the air on hunks of Jap flak. I remember one time I made a strike in a Jap ammunition dump in Tulele Bay. The dive to drop a load of incendiary bombs on the target, and the aircraft fire shot off the top cylinder of my engine. She pulled out of the dive and we headed home, 234 miles away. A little while later, when I landed at my base, the engineering officer ran out in the field to meet us, with his hair flying. "You can't be here," he said. "You're still 100 miles up the channel. Doggone it, it's impossible to fly a 14-cylinder engine on 13 cylinders. I hated to disappoint him, Mr. Bolton, but there wasn't any argument about it. We were there, thanks to the right cyclone engine.
And you're here now, Captain. I guess that clinches it. And I see that you're wearing the Distinguished Flying Cross, too. Did the Queen have anything to do with your winning that?
You bet she did. She won it for me. You know, Mr. Bolton, one day a couple of years ago, a fellow maybe out in Wisconsin walked into his bank and said, "Give me a war bond. I'd like to shake his hand, because he helped buy the Queen of Rabaul." 40 other Marine pilots would like to shake his hand, too, because to our way of thinking, that fellow latched on to the best investment anyone could make. He bought a good ship. He bought 19 Distinguished Flying Crosses for a pilot. He bought the lives of 40 of his neighbors.
Hats off to the Queen of Rabaul and her courageous pilots. Tonight we promise to bring you more exciting stories of our fighting men in the air. You're going to hear for the first time on any broadcast the actual nighttime jump of U.S. Army paratroopers. And you're going to meet the famous star, Ralph Bellamy. But now, let's not forget that today is Mother's Day. So tonight we have with us at our Gulf Oil microphone two mothers I'd like we the people to meet. They're Mrs. Lars Jensen and Mrs. Ada Phillips. Mrs. Jensen, where are you from?
My home is in Rapid City, South Dakota, Mr. Bolton.
Well, how about you, Mrs. Phillips?
I'm from Akron, Ohio.
Well, Mrs. Phillips, suppose you tell we, the people, what you've been doing.
Well, for 5 years, I've been on the production line at the Goodyear Aircraft Corporation. And twice, I've been chosen production queen by the workers.
Well, that certainly must have been a thrill, Mrs. Phillips.
Well, of course, I was excited about it, but really, I'm not out of the ordinary at all. There are thousands of American mothers like me who are backing up their sons in uniform. You see, I have a son in the Air Forces in Europe, one in the Medical Corps in India, one in the infantry in Italy, and the youngest in the Navy in the Pacific. That's a pretty big stake in the future, you know.
Well, you certainly had a hand in victory, Mrs. Phillips. How many planes have you helped to assemble, you suppose?
About 3,000, I guess. And I've hardly missed a day since I started. But, Mr. Bolton, when I think I have a long, hard day, I like to remember Mrs. Jensen and her ship.
Well, what's your ship, Mrs. Jensen?
I'm not on the assembly line, Mr. Bolton, but I work from 6 in the morning until midnight. You see, I've raised 3 families. First, I had my own 4 children, then my husband's brother's children, and now there are 7 little grandchildren in my care.
Goodness, I had my hands full with 4 boys. How do you manage, Mrs. Jensen?
It's not so very hard when you have a wonderful family and a little faith. I do all my own washing, ironing, and housework. And, of course, I have to keep the pantry full. For every year, I can 400 quarts from vegetables from a victory garden. Usually, there are at least 12 at the supper table.
And, Mrs. Jensen, I'll bet you can always find room for one more.
That's right. I'm waiting now for my 3 son-in-laws in the service to return to me. I always say that when there's room in your heart, there's room in your home.
Friends, you and I know that an automobile can't talk, but unfortunately, my automobile doesn't know that. The other night, when I drove it into the garage after a wet ride through the rain, it said,
I won't be doing that much longer.
Doing what?
Driving you around on nights like this. Pretty soon, I'll be resting in a nice junkyard. Pretty soon, you can get yourself a new car.
Well, 2 or 3 years isn't so soon.
2 or 3 years? You want me to keep going that long? Mr. Bolton, you better get yourself a horse.
Well, friends, if you want your present car to last till you can replace it, why not depend on your Gulf dealer and his protective maintenance services? For instance, right now is a mighty good time for you to get your Gulf dealer's spring changeover services. Have the Gulf man drain your crankcase of dirty oil, flush it, and refill with the right seasonal grade of fresh Gulf Pride, the world's finest motor oil. Have him Gulf Flex your car, too, to give vital points in the chassis and body better, longer-lasting protection. He can help keep your car's gears, cooling system, battery, and tires in the best of shape, too. For these and other Gulf protective maintenance services, call up your Gulf dealer for an appointment.
General Jimmy Doolittle has promised that tremendous fleets of super bombers are going to blast the enemy in the Pacific. We, the people, know that every dollar invested in the 7th War Loan will help build those planes. Tonight, we're proud to bring you a crew member of one of the first super fortresses to drop bombs on the Japanese. Our Hollywood reporter, Tom Hanlon, is waiting to interview Sergeant Ernest Brundage.
Ernie, you flew on several missions over Japan, didn't you?
Yes, Tom. And on our last mission, our engines caught fire, and we were forced to bail out. I landed in a rice paddy, and right away I heard people talking. I knew they had me spotted, and I thought they were Japs. But they were Chinese. They thought I was a Jap. I was the first American those people had ever seen, and was I lucky. You see, I'd landed less than a mile from the Jap lines when the Chinese guerrillas picked me up.
I bet you were glad to get out of there.
I didn't leave that area right away. Chinese guerrillas took me to their camp where I found our engineer, navigator, and co-pilot. The next morning, we went back with the guerrillas to keep the crashed plane from falling into Jap hands. But the Japs were there in force. A tough battle raged around the plane until the Japs were driven off, just long enough to remove everything movable from the bomber. We loaded the equipment into 200 wheelbarrows and brought it back to the guerrilla camp. Then they destroyed what was left of the plane. The bravery of those Chinese guerrillas is unbelievable.
And all this time you were on the move?
Oh, yes. We traveled 3 months in all. We're handed over from one guerrilla group to another. Finally, the Chinese helped us build an airstrip in a wheat field. When it was finished, we used a radio to summon a C-47 transport. It came in fast, didn't even cut its engine. It hauled our party aboard and dashed out.
Well, that certainly was a dramatic rescue. You must have done a lot of walking during those 3 months.
Well, from the site of our crash to the improvised landing strip where we were rescued, we traveled about 1,100 miles. Most of the time we walked, but we did travel on horses and boats when we could.
Do you think you'll be going back, Sergeant?
Well, Tom, I can't return overseas. If I were to be captured, the Japs would try to force me to tell how I was rescued. And this would endanger the guerrillas, who are of such great assistance to all of our men over there.
Thank you, Sergeant Ernest Brundage. Say, by the way, Sergeant, how old are you?
Well, Tom, I'm 22. Tomorrow is my birthday.
That calls for a celebration, Sergeant. We, the people, would like to present you with a birthday gift. Tell us, what would you like?
The best gift you can give to me or anyone else is a war bond.
And a war bond it will be from the Mighty Seventh. Thank you again, Sergeant Brundage. I return you now to Milo Bolton and we, the people, in New York.
Beside me now at our We the People microphone is a man who was responsible for building those same air bases from which Sergeant Brundage flew on his B-29 missions. We're proud to have as our guest Brigadier General Stuart C. Godfrey, who is in command of the aviation engineers in the India-Burma Theater. General Godfrey, we the people are eager to hear about the work of the aviation engineers.
Well, Mr. Bolton, our aviation engineers have the task of building airfields for the Army Air Forces. Airfields in a hurry, which are essential before an Air Force can launch its powerful blows. For this task, we have a wealth of bulldozers and other machines.
Well, that's right. I don't suppose you could build an airfield without bulldozers.
Well, amazingly enough, it can be done. I've seen it done in China. By the sheer mass labor of hundreds of thousands of willing coolies with little except rock from the river and their bare hands. I remember early in 1944, I flew over a vast paddy field where 90,000 laborers had been collected to build an airfield, one of several for our new super fortresses. 3 months later today, the first B-29 landed on this field, and not long afterwards, these huge planes made their first strike against Japan. The Chinese compare this feat with the building of their great wall.
General Godfrey, you said something about airfields in a hurry. Now, what's been the quickest job of airfield construction, to your knowledge?
I believe a year ago in Burma, the airborne engineers of Cochrane's air commandos landed at night with their midget equipment on a grassy field. By the following evening, it was ready to receive scores of planes carrying Wingate's men. But one of the most spectacular jobs we did was in following up Merrill's marauders. They captured the airfield at Michener in North Burma one morning. Naturally, it had been bombed out of commission, quite unfit for use. The same day that Merrill's men captured that strip, our aviation engineers flew in gliders with their light equipment. Within 48 hours, they had the field in operating condition. Later came much heavy equipment, also by air, and the construction of many new airfields.
Well, General Godfrey, those airfields that your aviation engineers are building are mighty essential to us, aren't they?
More than that, Mr. Bolton, they are the very lifeline of the campaign being waged now. Realize that General Stilwell's task force was largely supplied by air. Realize that the whole British 14th Army that recently captured Rangoon received their supplies mainly by air. That included food, ammunition, artillery, horses, mules, as well as personnel. This unprecedented job of air supply, as well as the more normal missions of bombing and strafing, were magnificently carried out by General Stratemeyer's integrated American-British Air Forces. The aviation engineers are indeed proud to be a part of this tremendous air show that will lead to the final destruction of Japan.
An aircraft carrier straddled by Japanese dive bombers as you pass through a narrow channel. Your men call the ship, the Fighting Lady. And if she's ever had to prove that she was worthy of that title, the time is now.
Target bearing broad on the beam, sir.
She's coming in fast, Captain Dixie. Any orders, sir?
Yeah, Bill. Get back after your battle station. I think this one's Gus. Right full rudder.
Right full rudder.
All ahead, flank speed.
All ahead, flank speed.
All right, Helfman. Stand by.
Yes, you know that skipper. You saw him in the motion picture, The Fighting Lady. You'll remember him as Captain Dixie, Captain Dixie Kiefer. And he's here tonight to tell we the people his story. Captain Kiefer, will you tell us about the action that we've just heard?
Well, about noon, we aboard the Fighting Lady saw a Jap plane diving on another carrier on our starboard quarter several thousand yards away. He's dropped his bomb on that carrier and then turned to us. As he pulled clear of the other carrier, my starboard batteries opened up and shot him down 500 yards away. I walked to the port side of the bridge and saw another plane coming out of a cloud close aboard and directly astern. He came up the flight deck, killing and wounding a number of my crew.
Well, Captain Kiefer, the Jap score at this point was one hit, one error. How about the third plane to attack you?
The third one came in off our port bow, but our battery shot him down. The fourth plane had better luck. We first spotted him coming in fast on our starboard beam. I remember about that time the executive officer reported to me, and I said, "Get back aft, Bill, to your battle station. I think this one's got us." The bomb exploded about 40 feet after me, instantly killing all exposed personnel and killing or wounding everybody on the bridge.
And I know that you were among the wounded, Captain Kiefer.
Yes, my most serious wound was a good-sized hole in my head where I'd been hit by shrapnel. I permitted the crew to send a quartermaster out to me. Between the two of us, we took care of my wounds. Then we went back to work.
Well, how many shrapnel wounds had you received altogether?
65. But you know, a nice thing happened to me when I finally got on the operating table that night. I asked the doctor about the crew, and he said, "Captain, the majority of the wounded were more worried about you than about themselves." That's the kind of a crew we had on the Fighting Lady, Mr. Bolton, and it represents the spirit of the whole Navy out there.
Well, Captain Kiefer, what do you think of the war that's ahead of us in the Pacific?
It's going to be tough, Mr. Bolton, plenty tough. The Japs are fanatics. They're continuing the war because their leaders are telling them that soon we'll get tired of fighting and give them an easy peace. Too many of our boys have died out there for that to happen, Mr. Bolton. For them and for the boys who will die if we fail, we've got to make victory in the Pacific not a phrase, but a complete and enduring fact.
Friends, you've probably often asked yourself this question: when will I be able to get a new car? Well, just a few days ago, along came a man with the answer. Fred M. Vinson, director of War Mobilization. He declared,
"A few cars may be coming off the assembly line in 6 to 9 months, but it will be a long time before they are produced in really large quantities. And there cannot be enough to meet pent-up civilian demand in less than 3 years."
Friends, since that is so, why not do this to help your present car last till you can replace it? Depend on your Gulf dealer to help you keep your car rolling with his Gulf Pride and Gulf Flex treatment.
Gulf Pride, the world's finest motor oil, gives precisely machined parts of your motor additional protection from the damaging effects of excess friction and harmful gum and sludge. That's because Gulf Pride is extra refined by the famous and exclusive Alclor process.
Gulf Flex lubrication. Scientific lubrication of vital points in the body and chassis of your car with Gulf Flex lubricants. Each one developed to do a particular job extra well.
How important it is that cars get extra good care is evidenced by the fact that the police of the country are now conducting a 6-week nationwide brake check program. Your brakes, your tires, every important part of your car should get regular attention if you want your car to last. To help it last a long, long time, depend on your Gulf dealer and his protective maintenance services.
Just 2 weeks ago, we the people brought you a memorable radio broadcast, the first nighttime snatch pickup from an Army glider. Tonight, we the people brings you the first radio broadcast of a nighttime parachute jump. You'll actually hear a paratrooper talk as he hits the silk and floats to Earth. Now standing by at the parachute school base at Fort Benning, Georgia, is we the people's reporter Lee Kirby. Come in, Fort Benning.
We have set up our We the People microphone on pitch black Lawson Field at the largest paratrooper training school in the world.
In just a few seconds, a C-46 transport plane of the 1st Troop Carrier Command will roar over the field, and we'll get into the plane for radio's first nighttime broadcast of an actual paratroop jump and a report from a paratrooper floating in the air. But while we're still on the ground, let's hear from some paratroopers who jumped in combat. First, Brigadier General Ridgely Gaither, Commandant of the Parachute School at Fort Benning.
Last March, I parachuted into Germany with a combat group of the 17th Division. I wanted to see at first hand if the training our paratroopers received here was adequate under combat conditions. I saw plenty. We jumped right into the teeth of a tremendous concentration of Jerry anti-aircraft fire, and our losses were heavy. But the courage of five paratroopers who hit the earth with me belies description. The six of us on the hard ground faced more than 20 Jerrys in a fortified position. But a sergeant, covered by the fire of only five men, crawled forward and hit the Jerry position with a phosphorus grenade. The Jerrys surrendered. The amazing part of the whole operation was that the paratroopers with me did not believe they were being heroic. To them, it was another day's work. But I guess a general should retire to the rear when real combat veterans are around. Men like Captain James J. Smith of New York City.
Thank you, sir. I've made parachute jumps in Sicily, Italy, France, and Holland. I guess Normandy was the toughest operation. What sticks in my mind is the time I led E Company of the 505th Parachute Infantry in a jump on Nijmegen, which was defended by fanatical SS troops. I saw one of our wounded boys being treated by one of our medics. An SS trooper shot and killed the medic and then deliberately tried to kill the wounded man. But we got the Jerry first.
Thank you, Captain Smith. Now here is Sergeant Jack D. Hughes of Boonville, Kentucky. Jack, what was your toughest jump?
I think the time we jumped on St. Merglise in Normandy invasion. The German machine guns kept firing me and another boy as we came down, but they didn't hit us. I still don't know how it happened, but we both landed behind machine gun and killed the Jerrys who had been firing us.
Thank you, men. But now let's go aboard the plane and see how those paratroopers feel about bailing out into the thin black air of night at 1,200 feet. In the plane is Weldon Heron. Take it away, Weldon.
We're about 5 miles from our drop zone run right now. In just a few seconds, these paratroopers loaded with death-dealing instruments will hurtle into the air. The plane is traveling at 110 miles an hour. But as these paratroopers leave, their bodies will travel even faster before their parachutes open into the life-saving umbrellas 3 seconds after that they clear the plane. The jumpmaster, Lieutenant George Malloy of Brookline, Massachusetts, has just turned away from the door of the open plane. Now he's been trying to sight the drop zone, and he's turning to give his commands to the men he'll follow him. Let's pick him up.
Get ready! Stand up! Cock up! Check your equipment!
Now each man is checking his own equipment and the equipment of the men directly in front, making the final examination of the life-saving gear.
Stand up for equipment check!
9 okay!
8 okay!
7 okay!
6 okay!
5 okay!
4 okay!
3 okay!
2 okay!
5 okay! Standing
up! And now we're standing by, waiting for just that moment when Lieutenant Malloy is going to give that final command to send them boys into the vest.
Let's go!
There they go. Out the plane, the men are catapulting into the open now. They've cleared the plane in 8 seconds. One of our paratroopers is carrying a walkie-talkie set. Let's hear from him as he goes down.
I'm only about 50 yards from the ground.
Gotta get into a landing position. I'm hitting the ground. I'm hitting.
That crash you just heard was the paratrooper hitting the ground. He landed about 100 yards from our microphone position, and right now he's collapsing his chute. Running toward our position now are several paratroopers who landed close by. Here's one of them. Your name and hometown.
Sergeant Stanley Grodzicki from Nanticoke, Pennsylvania.
You've jumped before?
Yes, sir.
In the night?
In the night.
How did it feel?
Feels well.
Thank you, Sergeant. Your name?
Sergeant Gerald J. O'Connor from Elmira, New York.
And you've made night jumps before,
yes,
Sergeant?
Yes, I have.
How about this one? Was it tough?
No, it wasn't too bad.
Your name?
Staff Sergeant William C. Wilson from Nashville, Tennessee.
And how was it, Sergeant?
It was great.
Thanks, Sergeant. And your name?
Sergeant John Wolfe from Linden, Michigan.
From Linden, Michigan, and the last man to get up here. Thanks a whole lot, Sergeant. How was that jump?
It's fine.
All right, I think we have more men coming up. Your name?
Lieutenant Dumont.
Lieutenant Dumont, and you're out of breath, Lieutenant.
I am.
Have you made many night jumps?
About 10.
And where have you jumped before?
France, Italy, Africa.
That was certainly a nice jump you made there, and thanks a lot, Lieutenant. And thank you all, men. Thank you, Army Ground Forces of the Parachute School. It was a grand demonstration, superbly staged. Congratulations on your third anniversary, and we return you now to Milo Bolton and We the People in New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you all know, our president called upon our nation to observe this Sunday, May 13th, as a day of prayer. We the People wants to join in that observance. And so we share with you a poignant stanza that might well have been offered by men kneeling on the sands of Okinawa. To bring you this prayer, Gulf Oil is invited to our We the People microphone the distinguished actor, Ralph Bellamy. Mr. Bellamy.
Well, God, here we are. You up there, me down here, with a burning sun, a mess of insects, too much ocean, and other buddies just as lonely as me. Oh, God, how nice it must be back home, with Germany licked, and the folks humming, and some of the boys all finished with the fighting. But I guess that wasn't for me, was it? Tomorrow, I'll still be dodging bullets, still feeling lost in the middle of the night. Well, no hard feelings. I'll go wherever you say, do whatever you want me to. You know what's best for me. But say, if you can only get the people back home to remember me, maybe they'll still bear down. Maybe they'll still send us their blood, still stay on the job, still keep making the stuff we need. You see, God, I'd like to get home, too. Fellow Americans, let's all remember the mighty Seventh. Buy war bonds.
We the people speak. This is Milo Bolden again, reminding you that next week at this same time, the Gulf Oil Companies and your neighborhood Good Gulf Dealers will bring you another exciting program of real people with real experiences.
Car owners, to help protect your life and the lives of others, make sure your brakes are in good condition. Gulf Oil reminds you that to help prevent accidents, the police of the nation ask you to cooperate in their nationwide brake check program by having your brakes checked now.
Music for We the People is by Oscar Bradley. Remember, listen in at this same time next week when you'll hear
We the People. CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.